Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is mastering engineer Ron McMaster. First of all, Spotify fake artists. A few months ago, I told you the story about Spotify's fake artists. Now, what happened is, on a bunch of ambient-style playlists, like Peaceful Piano and Deep Focus, Sleep, Music for Concentration, Ambient Chill. So it turns out on those particular playlists, there were some artists on there that nobody recognized that were getting a huge number of streams. So people began to check it out, and what they discovered was they were all done by the same Stockholm production house called Epidemic Sound. And after more digging, it turns out that these songs were all licensed at a lower rate by Spotify and then given fake names. So as a result, Spotify was making more money. To make things even worse, legit artists in the genre like Brian Eno and John Hopkins, Bibio, people like that, were big losers because 90% of the artists on the playlist were fake. And especially major labels, all of their artists were almost completely frozen out. So while everyone complained about it, Spotify said it was going to change things, it doesn't seem like it's changed after a few months. So now the major labels are going to Apple Music and they're saying, we're going to give you an exclusive for an alternative ambient playlist, and it's called Peaceful Music. Already, the ambient playlists are doing well on Apple Music. Today's Chill is one. Chill House is number 60 out of all their playlists. Piano Chill is number 64. So a lot of people really like ambient music and use it for all sorts of different things. Use it for background music, use it for relaxing, use it for meditating, all those things. But imagine now if you're an indie artist doing that, and let's face it, a lot of them are, and suddenly you can't even get on Spotify because Spotify's own artists are taking up all the slots in the playlist. Well, now you might have a chance because Apple Music is looking at this a little bit harder and they're being very proactive about it. So I can see why Spotify did this. I don't know that it's something that anyone would condone, but obviously they want to make money because now that they're public, they have to make money. That doesn't mean it's right, and now Apple Music, among others, are going to try to rectify the situation. So if you want that kind of music, you can help out your fellow artists by just listening to it on Apple Music alone. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions at BobbyOInnerCircle.com. Just a heads up that my new book, The Music Business Advice Book, is now available and is the number one bestseller on the Amazon Music Business charts. It's comprised of 150 immediately useful tips compiled from the interviews from this podcast. You'll find it on Amazon and most other online book retailers, as well as a music store near you. And again, thank you all for your support. Now, another thing I mentioned a few months ago are the imports, the musical and pro audio imports. And we know a lot of those devices, a lot of those instruments come from outside the country. And everyone was wondering what was going to happen when the Trump duties kicked in. Well, we really don't know for sure because that just happened. But one thing we do know is that already things were actually taking a downturn on the import market. Music Trades, who tracks this stuff pretty closely, found that most categories were down last quarter as far as the imports were concerned. The only thing that was up in musical instruments were ukuleles and acoustic guitars priced over $299. Now, in pro audio, power amps are way down by about 29%, while microphones are up by 46%. When they traced it back, they found that Gibson was a lot of the cause on the instrument side. And the reason why was the company entered into bankruptcy. And when that happened, all the overseas suppliers curtailed their shipments, at least in the short term. Now, Gibson seems to be back on track, even though they're still in bankruptcy and they probably won't be out until sometime in September. But that being said, it looks like sales and operations are back to where they were before. Now, for the bad news, the Trump trade duties kicked in on July 6th. There's a 25% duty on aluminum and circuit boards. And on August 23rd, another 25% went on musical instruments and accessories like cases and tuners and cables and effects pedals and even wireless products. So we don't know what the quarter is going to bring, but it's looking more and more like imports are going to be way down or prices are going to go way up. So don't be surprised if you go to the store or you go online to buy something that you really need and it's a lot more expensive than it is today. So it's probably best go and buy now because pretty soon you might be surprised at the price. Ron McMaster recently retired from Capitol Records Mastering after 38 years with the company. During that time, he specialized in cutting vinyl and mastered a wide variety of genres and artists that include everything from Frank Sinatra to George Harrison, Radiohead, the Beach Boys, and the Rolling Stones. That said, his vinyl work with the Blue Note catalog has become prized by both jazz and audiophile listeners on a par with the great Rudy Van Gelder. Believe it or not, Ron just signed a deal with Jack White's Third Man Records for a record that he did as a drummer with his band Public Nuisance in 1968, proving that you're never too old if the music is good. During the interview, Ron talked about the changes in mastering over the years, the resurgence of vinyl, and about some very cool projects that he's mastered. We spoke via phone from his home in Los Angeles. I want to go back to the beginning with you. How did you get into mastering? Because that's not really something, especially when you started, that people aspired to or even knew about for that matter. So how did it happen to you?
Well, I was a drummer and I played drums and in a band, and then I did some studio work. And back in the day when I was doing this is back in the 70s, there were all the little studios, the smaller studios, you know, like a Gold Star or Sound Recorders, which was one I was associated with. They all had small disc cutting rooms and would cut acetates for clients and everything like that. So I saw this and it fascinated me, and I thought, well, I'd like to do something like that. You know, it was just had a more of a variety. I don't kind of have the personality to be a mixer or a tracking engineer. I wanted more of a variety and more of a turnaround. So that's how I started seeing it. And then a good friend of mine was working at A&M Records in the evening in the late 70s. And he was cutting parts for Bernie when Bernie was still over there. And I would go over there at night and watch him cut and learn.
You learned from Bernie?
No, I didn't learn from Bernie. I learned from Bob Carbone. He was Bernie's cutting engineer. He cut Bernie's parts.
Ah.
Bernie would do the EQ during the day and then have the notes and everything for what the client approved, and then they would cut the parts at night.
So when did you get your first gig?
When did I get in mastering?
Yeah.
It was in 1980. Actually, the same person, my friend Bob at A&M, was working with a client, and he was, at the end of his session, the guy asked him if he knew of anybody that was apprenticing. They couldn't afford a hotshot disc cutting engineer, but they needed somebody to help them out over at their studio, which was United Artists. And that's how I got, Bob said, you got to call this guy. And so I called him and went over and interviewed and got the job. So, because by this time I had been studying and sitting around and learning how to cut a record for about a year plus. So I went in as an apprentice, and that's how I got started. And then a little bit later, the company United Artists was purchased by EMI. And so, you know, that was the United Artists. It had the Liberty Records catalog. It had the Blue Note, and it had World Pacific Jazz and all those labels. So that was all acquired by EMI, and then that's how I fell under the EMI blanket.
Ah, I get it now. Okay. So do you remember the first disc that you cut?
First disc that I cut? I actually do remember it. It was an interview record. T-Rex, Mark Bolan.
Oh, okay.
It was a Mark Bolan interview record, and that was the first record that I cut as a cutting engineer where I had a client that came in. I wasn't just doing some production, production work. This was a full on session. So, and if, in fact, I still know that gentleman today. He was at my retirement party a few weeks back.
Oh, cool. Yeah. When CDs first came in, did you get into that right away or did you keep cutting vinyl?
No, we got into it right away. I mean, we were still cutting vinyl, but all of the labels, all of the companies were frantically training all the engineers how to make a CD, how to operate the digital equipment. And I can clearly remember, going to different classes and things that Sony would put on, and everybody was frantically taking notes and learning how to operate, the 1610, 1630 machines and transferring analog to digital and working in that format. So it was kind of a mad rush at the time because the label, like all the other labels, our label, they wanted to get everything. They saw this new format coming and they wanted to get everything out on CD. So it was a matter of, huge orders of huge requests of let's get this, let's get that. So, it was pretty frantic.
How did you find it after cutting nice warm sounding analog? And then all of a sudden you go into digital, which has a different sound, a different feel and a different working process. What was that like for you?
Well, it was an adjustment. It was very different. It was new to all of us. So I can't say that because the rest of the guys kind of felt the same way. They had worked either in the analog format, whether they were disc cutting or making transfers or, production copies or things like that. So, it was all very different. The sound and just getting used to the levels that you could put on the limitations were so much less than they were with vinyl that you could do certain things and get away with them. That's the part that was kind of, I remember all of us kind of being in awe of, we can do that. We can raise the level there a little bit. And you weren't limited to, let's say, if you were mastering a vinyl record on a 23 minute side, you certainly have a level limitation and you didn't have that when it came to doing a digital master.
But that being said, again, it's a whole new way of working. And I can remember 1630s. I'm not a mastering engineer, but I have lots of friends that were, and I remember back to those days and going in and thinking, well, this is video editing only with numbers because that's what it was, right?
Well, yeah, right. Little zeros and ones,
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it was entirely different in the approach and just entirely different. And then the fact that, you had more, you could put more information on the tape, right? I mean, you basically had 80 minutes or 74 at the time, as was Capitol's standards. So, on early albums like the Beach Boys, people got real upset when you'd only put, they would release one album. Those albums were typically, 15, 16 minute sides and people wanted more information. So they felt for their money, they wanted a little more bang for their buck. So, right away the phone started ringing. And so then they started putting out, two and three albums on one disc, so they wouldn't have the complaints.
Yeah, but I know that there's the time limitation on vinyl, but there was also something that really worked with that because I think there's a attention span.
Mm-hmm.
When you have a 40-minute album, and when I look back and all the ones that I love, they're between 35 and, 42, 43 minutes. And then when you have something that goes longer than that, it's really easy to zone out, not really hear it. I look back at it and I think, well, it was a limitation, but in fact, it was one that really worked to everyone's advantage, I think.
Oh, I think so too. And I would tell my clients just, up until I retired, if they, we were doing a CD mastering session, and they had a 35 or 40 minute program, I always encouraged it, because you know there people are going to play a record like that on a CD a lot more than they're going to play a 74, 75 minute CD. They just burn out on it, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. I totally agree, and and that's what I hear from a lot of the people when I ask them, you know, currently the young kids, what do you like so much about vinyl? You know, what's the draw? And they like to be able to get their friends together and put on a record and sit down and listen to the whole side. Maybe it's, you know, 20 minutes or something, 18, 20 minutes long, and then turn it over and listen to the next side. That's the part they enjoy. The streaming, the music that just on files that's just going on forever and a day, it's kind of almost background music, you know?
Yeah.
They do other things while that's playing, whereas if they're listening to a vinyl record, they're actually taking time out, and it's a whole process was the same that you and I enjoyed when we were young, and our friends would call up and say, hey, you got to hear this new Doors album, you know?
Yeah.
And everybody run over there and take a seat and check it out and play it again.
Yeah, right. I remember that. You're saying that you know that there are younger people that, in fact, do that. And I've heard it. I haven't seen it for myself, but I think it's really healthy. That's a good thing for music if it happens like that.
Yeah, I think it is, too. And I mean, because I would get young kids coming in all the time. They were totally interested in seeing how a record was cut and that whole process, whereas 10 years ago, 15 years ago, nobody cared. I mean, no, we don't want to know that. What's the big draw? But now, you know, nowadays, everybody wants to know how a record's made. And part of that, when I would explain the whole process, is the limitations and the sides and this type of thing. And I think they got it because, you know, it led to a better sounding album than just plain digital file.
Yeah, right. You've seen a lot of things happen here. Why do you think vinyl has made a comeback?
Well, I think it's one of them. One of the things is the dynamics, the change in the sound, a little warmer sound. The other thing I think is also what we just talked about is the people like they get together. They hold an album. It's bigger. It's out, you know, they can read the credits. They can see the artwork. All of the things that we enjoyed about sitting down and having a little LP listening session are the same things that I hear from all the young folks when I ask them. It's that group participation. Come on over and let's listen to this. And we talk about it and then we change the side and maybe we play it again, or we pick the song we like the best. I just think it's all those things that we've been talking about that they tell me that's what they like about a record, because it's, and you know, there's something about being able to hold a record where everything now is a file and, you know, it's, yeah, there's nothing there, but it's on your phone, just a title, or even a picture is the thumbnail size. And so to see the artwork and to see some of the stuff that how it was intended, especially the older records that they bring back, some of the Blue Note stuff and things and how they originally were put out, they really dig it, you know?
Well, speaking of Blue Note, so you're noted for the jazz records that you cut, and obviously you've done a lot of that through your career. But you've also done lots of other things that are more modern and as modern as you can get. I'm just wondering, is your approach different depending on the genre of music that you're cutting?
Well, my approach is the same. However, I say that because I know the different formats have different requirements and need to sound differently. So I approach it in the same way for mastering. But I also know that if I'm doing a Pet Sounds record, I have different things I have to keep in mind that people are expecting the record to sound like versus maybe a jazz, a Blue Note album, maybe a John Coltrane record or a Miles Davis record. The low end or the bottom is going to be a little different. So I deal with that in a different way. But I still try to keep the same approach, give it as good a level that I can, watch all for the sibilance and distortion areas, and get it to sound as good and as natural as the original master sounded. So the client and the person that the buyer that ends up getting it, they put it on, they go, yeah, that's that's the way it's supposed to sound. And it's not, muddied up, or it's not, the low end isn't all notched out or any of that stuff. It's got everything that was intended to be on that record. So, but technically I use the same approach that I would on all the records, because, that doesn't mean I'm going to make them sound all the way same, but I am going to take that same, time and care to make sure that they sound as good as the master is intended to sound.
How long does it take you to cut a record? And I know that there's the playing time, obviously, of the record, but in terms of prep time and everything else, what does it take to cut in terms of time?
Oh, I could easily do. Well, I have done 3 albums in a day, but I could do two when times were busy, but because you have shipping deadline as well, like 5 o'clock shipping deadline, and I usually would get started around 8:30 in the morning. So I'd say probably about 3.5 or 4 hours per record by the time I run it down. And this is from this would be from mostly from the digital files that I have, as far as, because a lot of those have been archived, so we don't use the tape. If it's coming from tape, it's going to take me longer, and then I'm probably going to just get one, maybe half of another one done. With the files, it's a little quicker.
Why is that?
Well, I was just going to say it's a little, because when I get the files that have been archived, and these guys, I'm talking about, where they take care of all the old tapes and they've cleaned up all the old splices and they've cleaned up all the edits and the leader and nothing, when you're handling the tape for the first time in 10, 15 years, all of the splices usually break on you. The paper leader always kind of breaks on you. So you end up repairing just to get it to play properly, so it's not, you don't hurt the tape at all.
I get
it. That splicing tape that they made years ago for all of the tapes wasn't meant to last but maybe 10 years. And so now you're pulling out records, so like some of the old Blue Note stuff that I would get that Rudy did in the 50s, if it hadn't been, I can always tell right away if it had been taken care of and cleaned up a lot of times by me. But if it was someone else, and if it hadn't been, then you have to be real gingerly, rewind it and make sure you fix all the splices and all the edits before you can even start to play the record or the master. That's what takes the time.
You were at Capitol for a long time. What, 38 years? Is that what it was?
Yeah, 35 years, actually. I took 3 years off and had my own business for a little while, but then I came back, and I was still go down there and cut records for them because Wally Trogdon at the time was getting ready to retire, and so I would fly down there from Sacramento and cut vinyl on the weekends for those guys. And one of my trips down there, when I came back, they said, hey, you want to come back to work? And I was running out of money, and I liked it there. I knew everybody. I didn't burn any bridges. So I came back, and so that was from 93 to 96, I was gone. So.
Okay. But that being said, you were at Capitol for a really long time. But you know all the other people in the mastering side of the business for sure, and you know how independents work and what's going on with them. But Capitol was a completely different experience. You were in an environment that was way different than most other mastering engineers.
Yes.
So how was that for you then? I mean, there's a certain amount of security that's involved in that, but did you have the same freedom as everybody else had in the business, or did you think better or worse than being an indie?
No, it was very challenging. I liked it because it really, even from working prior to going to the tower, I went into that building in 1986 in December. I worked down the street at EMI Liberty Records, which was at Sunset and Orange. And that was different. That was probably a little more like what you're referring to in the way that people, there wasn't as much going on. I mean, at Capitol, there's the best artists in the world come through that door every day. And it's not uncommon for you to be called on and say, hey, so-and-so needs some edits done right now. Can you help them out? And you go, okay, sure. You just do it. It's very challenging. It really makes you stay on your toes, because these people are, people that people like the Beach Boys and major artists like that are coming in and they're asking for an acetate on this, or they want to do this kind of a record, and they want to have a certain sound, and they want to talk to you about how their record's going to be. And one day I was cutting Pet Sounds for a special release. And some of the Beach Boys came in when the producer brought them in, because we were working on the release of I think it was the 25th anniversary of that sound record. So for me to be cutting their record while they were watching me was really kind of surrealistic.
Yeah, I bet.
I'd been a fan for a long time. So, and right away, Al Jardine says, oh, I need an acetate of that. I got to have that. They still love the vinyl. So I said, sure, I'll do it, And so things like that happen where they never would happen at a lot of studios. You just don't have the access to the talent that comes through the doors.
Yeah. Do you have a project that's the most memorable?
Oh, that's like when a lot of people ask me what's the most favorite record you ever cut, and I can't really ever answer that. But one of the most memorable was being able to cut that the Blue Note catalog, the early catalog, all the Rudy Van Gelder tapes before they did the Rudy Van Gelder series and program reissues, and where he remastered his own vinyl. I cut a lot of that Blue Note, those Blue Note releases. That's got to be right there on the top of the list. It's just beautiful. The music is just amazing, and the talent that came out of that small little period of time in our life, it just continued to blow my mind. I mean, just like, when you Duke Ellington and, Cannonball and Miles Davis. And it was fun because, some of the engineers, the older engineers that were, they've retired way before I did. One guy knew Cannonball, and he would tell me stories about how he would come over and, hang out and do things even if he wasn't in a session and stuff like that. So those are the kind of things that, you just knew happened all the time around there.
Was there one that was particularly difficult to cut?
No, not really. Most of the ones that I'm talking to you about were done intentionally as an album should have been. In other words, they were like 18, 20 minute sides.
Mm-hmm.
The harder ones to cut are the ones that currently people want to put out where they're 23, 24 minute sides. Or one time I had a group come in and they had a 26 minute side. It was all reggae. Well, that's all bottom end, and, eats up all the land. I told them all the pitfalls and that they weren't going to like their record. But they insisted I cut it, and so I cut it. And then they came back a month later and said, "Oh, you were right. We don't like it. We'll take off some songs, and they made it, you know, a regular record. So, but I don't have one particular one that I can think of right now that gave me trouble or was difficult, you know.
Okay, here's something else then, a little geeky. Did your lathe ever get updated or upgraded, or was it basically the same the whole time you were there?
Oh, they were always, the guys in the shop would always always check the calibration and always update it. And I had a few things that would go awry. And then I, well, at that time, we had the other lathe in the storage. So they went and would get the parts from that and swap it out right quick while they fixed the broken part that I had. But, you know, essentially it was the same lathe, but it was constantly being, and they still are, being, you know, upgraded and checked for speed and the bearings and where the calibration is supposed to be for the plant. So it's an ongoing, service that you have to be. You just can't let them just keep running.
What monitors were you using?
I had the PMCs for my small monitors, and then I had the
Augsburgers.
George Augsburger designed my room.
Oh, okay. Westlake?
Yeah, Westlake Audio. Yeah, thank you.
Okay. That's unusual. I wouldn't have thought that you would have been using Westlakes, but that being said, I guess it's like anything else. You get used to it, and it really doesn't matter. As long as you're used to it, you can make it work.
Well, I got used to it. Exactly. They were old school. They're big. They're, you know, they had the big horns and everything up there, and it's all what you kind of get used to. I lived in that room for, you know, 30 some years, so I just got used to it, and it's much different than mastering rooms today that you see the new ones, you know.
Now, that being said, now that you've retired from Capitol, you're still working and you're still doing projects as they come to you. Where are you doing them?
I haven't done any yet.
Oh, okay.
I haven't done any. I've just been kind of recuperating and catching up on my rest and so forth. So I haven't done anything yet. I'll probably do some stuff at Capitol because, you know, they're not going to change the room around essentially too much. And so, I'll probably be asked to do some stuff over there and work on that lathe. You know, it kind of depends. I'm not quite sure yet because it's still a little new in my retirement. And so, and then I plan on also doing, you know, some panel, working on sitting on some panels and discussing vinyl cutting and different things. I've been asked to do maybe some little bit of teaching and that type of thing. So.
Mm-hmm.
I want to kind of try to go into that zone. I really have I've been doing it quite such a long time. I didn't really plan on opening up my own room because that would just really equal working again.
Yeah, right.
putting all that energy into getting clients and building up a business. And, you know, at this stage of my life, you know, how much longer could I do it? I don't want to. I'd rather go out on a good note. I don't want to have them put out a bad record, or I don't want to have anything like that. But I'd like to share my knowledge and be able to, you know, help and do whatever I can to let people know how things should be done.
Sure. Okay. So one last thing, public nuisance. Tell me about that.
Oh my gosh. Well, that was a band that I was in since. It started out as a surf band in the eighth grade, and then we developed into our, the public nuisance was the same guys, and we played together, and we ended up doing a record. We got signed with CBS Equinox Records and, under Terry Melcher. And so we came to LA and we did an album, and, then at the last minute, nothing came out. It got shelved, and we were all disappointed and were real frustrated because nothing happened. So we did some auditions and things like that. But then after that, the band kind of broke up. And then long story short, many years later, there was a guy in Sacramento that was doing a a CD compilation of, you know, garage bands of the 60s from Sacramento. And he asked if he heard one of our songs and he liked it. So he goes, "Hey, you guys got any more?" And we said, "Yeah, we've got a whole album." And so we released it on our own because we had the tapes and everything. And so we sold the first 1,500 CDs. So then we printed up some more and then sold those. And then at that point, it kind of got a little expensive to reproduce the booklet. So, but then in the interim, Jack White had gotten a hold of it, and he was White Stripes. They were covering one of our songs or a few of our songs. And one of our fans told us about it. And so then, Third Man Records, got a hold of us and asked our label. We had said one guy label in Sacramento, if we were going to do any more. And he said, no. And we said, no. And he said, well, we're interested in signing. So they got a hold of us and we signed a record contract with Third Man. And then I said, well, we'll sign it if I can cut my own record. And they said, oh, sure. We know who you are. And so I cut my own record.
What was that like?
Then, I was my worst client. I drove myself nuts that day. I always remember that day because, you know, you're just trying, you just go crazy. So, but I got it done and it came out fine and everybody was happy with it. So, then we're still on Third Man. And one of my things that I would tell my clients up until the very end was, you know, hey, listen, if I can sign a record contract in my 60s, for something I did when I was 19 years old, you can't tell me that you're going to be giving up, you know? That was my mantra. You don't give up. You keep going because you never know what is going to happen. And that's what's happened with Third Man. And so that's one of the things they've asked me if I would like to, when they heard I was retiring, go back to the plant there in Detroit and help. They're going to host me and I'm going to do some talking on vinyl and working with some of their cutters and things like that.
Oh, that's great. Very cool.
Yeah, that'll be a lot of fun. And those guys are terrific. So,
yeah.
I still plan on, you know, being in touch with the vinyl and making sure that I'm still, you know, part of the audio scene and the community and try to give as much information that I can to help others that haven't had the time and experience that I have had, been lucky enough to have had in the field, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, Ron, one last question.
Yes.
You've been in the business for a really long time. That being said, you've been in the corporate environment and that shields you a little bit from having to do business, but it doesn't mean you're shielded completely. So what's the best piece of business advice that maybe you learned along the way or someone imparted to you?
Well, I think it's always, you need to listen to what people have to say. If you're asking for advice on a particular project, how it should be done, then you should take notes on what the engineer is telling you. If you're not sure how a record is going to be, maybe, make contact. Like, in other words, I had no problem with folks calling me and saying, "Hey, I've got this record I want to master. I want to bring it in for vinyl." And I would say, "Well, how long is it?" And they would tell me it's, you know, way over 24, 25 minutes long. And I would say, "Well, I would suggest that you either lose some of the songs because it's okay for your record to be a little different than your CD or your files. But at the same time, do your record justice. If you want to show yourself off, make sure it's a nice, you know, playable side that the engineer, whoever cuts it, not, it doesn't have to be me, but whoever cuts it can get a good cut, get a good level on it. And the listener and the person that purchases it is going to be satisfied, not disappointed." Mm. Or you can also take another direction and you can, you know, I would suggest then if you want all your songs on there, then make a double album.
Yeah, right.
And so they would do that, you know, they would listen to me on that way. I would just try to make sure I give them all of the ideas that we could have and that could be available, so they could see their options. That was the biggest thing, because truly it's all new to all of the new artists out there, because they don't know the vinyl world and they're born in the digital age. So I find, half of the time what I would be educating and telling everyone what they should and what they shouldn't expect. You know, a lot of times they just assume, oh, I can just do that. And then you have to say, well, no, let's just say, for example, doing your record is going to take probably from the time you walk into a cutting room to the time you've received your final product is going to be 3 to 4 months. And so they're not expecting that. In other words, I did all my Christmas albums this last year in May, just so they could make sure they had everything on the shelf,
Yeah.
So some of these folks, literally, they're planning their release party and they're way in a whole different direction. And they should be asking those kind of questions. How long is this going to take? What do I need to do to prepare for this? I want to have it out by a certain time. Will I make it?
Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, Google Play, and now Google Podcasts. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-in form for my newsletter and for alerts to new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.